From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The Sopranos returns to HBO Sunday to conclude its final season. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at what's to come. Also, we feature interviews with Joey Ganascoli, who played Vito on the show before Vito got whacked, and with Lorraine Bracco, who plays Dr. Melfi, Tony Soprano's psychiatrist. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Grindhouse, the new double feature by directors Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. This Sunday, HBO begins rolling out the final episodes of The Sopranos, a series that altered the TV landscape when it premiered way back in 1999. All the antiheroes you're enjoying on TV these days, from Vic Mackey on The Shield to Gregory House on House, exist, at least in part, because of the complexity and popularity of Tony Soprano. So today, we're saluting The Sopranos as it begins its stretch run. On today's show, we'll visit with Joey Ganascoli, whose character Vito was killed in the first half of the season, after he was outed as a gay mobster and went into hiding. And with Lorraine Bracco, whose character of Dr. Melfi still is with the show and still leading Tony in therapy sessions. And we'll start with a review of the first episodes of the new season, courtesy of our TV critic, me. It's been 9 months since we last saw a fresh episode of The Sopranos. This weekend, it's back to conclude its sixth and final season with 9 new episodes. The network provided only the first 2 for preview, and to me, that's a very good sign. It means that finally, after 8 years of following Tony Soprano and his crew, the end really is near. Last season, for the most part, was about laying the foundation for the final push. This new season starts out just the same, with people around Tony circling him with their own motives and resentments. The feds are still investigating, and Sunday's episode opens with the local cops making their move. The New York mob is about to undergo another power shift, and Tony, down in Jersey, may be targeted. And even in Tony's own camp, his trusted lieutenants have their own long simmering issues, and his kids are young adults now, ready to make their own choices. David Chase, creator of The Sopranos, knows we're all waiting for a big ending to his epic series. So what does he do to start his swan song season? He presents an episode where the dramatic highlight, and the comedic one, come in a scene where Tony plays a game of Monopoly. It sounds absurd, I know, but what's really going on is amazingly multi-layered. The conversation touches on all sorts of old issues and family dynamics. Tony is acquiring as much as he can any way he can, just as in real life. And, this will surprise no one, Tony cheats. Here's James Gandolfini as Tony, Edie Falco as his wife Carmela, Ada Turturro as his sister Janice, and Steve Sharippa as her husband Bobby, all proving that Monopoly and alcohol don't mix.
You're in chess. Pay hospital $100, me.
What are you doing? It goes in the bank.
We play the free parking rule.
What free parking rule?
Money from community chess and chance goes into the middle. Whoever lands on free parking gets the money.
You show me that in the rules.
Technically, it isn't in the rules, but a lot of people play it that way. It adds a whole new level of excitement to the game.
I don't agree with it.
Bobby, when we were growing up in our house, this is how we played.
You know, the Parker brothers took time to think this all out. I think we should respect that.
The Parker brothers, just play the game.
It's a funny scene, but is it a waste of time? Anything but. What we're witnessing is Bobby, the trusted brother-in-law, daring to stand up to Tony. The longer they play the game, and the more Bobby drinks, the bolder he gets. And before it's over, their dynamic is a lot different than when the game started. That's a perfect metaphor for the entire series. For years on The Sopranos, Tony has been going around the board grabbing property and taking money by any means he can. But now, how's the game going to end? Tony, a changed man after almost dying from a gunshot wound last year, is concerned about legacy and family. But what's left, for him and for The Sopranos? I like the 2 episodes that begin this final stretch, but I'm even more excited by what I haven't seen. The fact that HBO and Chase sent out only 2 episodes for preview, rather than the usual 4, suggests that something big will happen in the next few weeks. I have to say, as a diehard Sopranos fan, it's about time. I've been able to forgive the pace of The Sopranos by thinking of it as a grand novel, but it's time for that novel to wrap up its plot lines. There are only so many ways to go out with a bang. Tony can die, maybe at the hands of a trusted friend or relative. Tony can go to prison or into the witness protection program. One of Tony's closest family members can be killed, and Tony can seek revenge. Or one of those family members can take over, leaving Tony to attend therapy sessions and feed ducks. I'd settle for any or many of the above. These characters are so deep, the acting so good, the writing so dense, the possibilities are mouthwatering. The one thing The Sopranos has to avoid, if it wants to be remembered as one of the best dramatic TV series ever made, is the one ending I fear the most. The non-ending. The Russian up a tree ending, where The Sopranos doesn't conclude, but just stops. More than anything portrayed in the entire series, that would be a crime. Coming up, one of The Sopranos characters who got whacked in the first half of this season. The first half of the sixth season of The Sopranos is out on DVD for those who want to catch up before the second half begins Sunday. One of the major players in those episodes was Joey Ganascoli, who played Vito Spatafor. Vito had been a familiar supporting character for much of the show, one of the trusted members of Tony's crew. But Vito had a secret. A couple of guys collecting protection money at a gay bar spotted Vito dancing there. After word got out, Vito panicked, left his wife and two kids, and fled to New Hampshire, where he got involved in a relationship with the owner of a diner, a guy he nicknamed Johnny Cakes. Vito lied to Johnny Cakes and claimed to be a writer from Scottsdale working on a book about boxing. Here's a scene right after Johnny Cakes figured out that Vito wasn't who he said he was.
Are you even a sports writer? I mean, here we are talking about taking the next step in this relationship. I ask you to share my home, and you can't even be straight with me. This. Nice knowing you, Vincent.
Jimbo, come on. I'm not a writer, okay? I'm not from Scottsdale. And the car's not my sister's. I'm actually from New Jersey.
I knew it.
Some went down. I had to leave. My home, my contracting business, my wife, my kids.
Are you drunk? It's not even 11 o'clock.
You think it's easy? I miss home so bad my heart's a f***ing lump. I'm barely holding together. Stuck in the sticks, running out of money. And now this? You think I was looking for you?
Soon after this scene, Vito decided to return to New Jersey, where his fellow mobsters were waiting to kill him. Terry spoke with Joey Ganascoli last year, just after Vito met his untimely fate. Ganascoli was a chef before he became an actor and recently co-authored a novel called A Meal to Die For. It's about a gourmet chef who's connected to the mob.
Joseph Ganascoli, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this season. It was you've just been really good. It's been a great part for you, and it was really fun to watch you.
Thank you.
All the people in Tony's crew are revolted by the idea that Vito is a homosexual, and after Vito is outed, they no longer trust you, and it's obvious, right. Pretty obvious right away. You're gonna get killed eventually. Do you have any friends who are as homophobic as the characters in The Sopranos and who were revolted by your portrayal in the same way that the characters in the series were revolted by Vito when they found out who he was?
Yeah, my friends were like me. How many times are you going to kiss this guy? And they would ask, like, if I would have killed 20 guys in the night, there would have been, a lot more pleased with that, but to be with another guy, it's something else. And, I'm from Brooklyn also, and I go to restaurants that, mob hangouts, and, some guys give me dirty looks, They're a little upset about it, but, I'm acting, and, it happens, and it's a role that maybe, made a name for myself, so I don't have a problem with it.
Just as your character, Vito, is becoming sympathetic, and we realize, this character's been repressed. He could have had a different life. He could have had a better life. He didn't necessarily have to be, killing people in the mob. Then, you decide that even though you're in New Hampshire, and you miss your kids, and you miss part of your old life in the mob. So you leave New Hampshire, and you're driving on this, country road going back to Jersey, and you hit a car that stopped next to a mailbox, and the driver has been checking his mail. The driver insists that the accident has to be reported to the insurance company, and you can't afford to do that because then you'd be discovered and probably killed. So you just shoot him in the back of the head. And, I thought the writers were so brilliant in that scene because really, you're not a good person in the series. You know, you've killed other people. You shot Jackie Jr. in the back of the head, and that's just like one of the things you've done. And you still have it in you to just be a killer. Did you like that scene?
Up until then, I thought I was very sympathetic. And but one thing great about David Chase is that he doesn't want you to really like these people. Whenever you know people start saying, "Hey, they're regular guys," you know, they're sitting around watching a game, we're at a strip place, or they're you know, just hanging out, and then they do something like when Paulie Walnuts had to kill his mother's friend just to give Tony, you know, some money, and when people are thinking like, "Yeah, you know, the guy just wants to, you know, live and let live," he shows them that that's who they are. They're killers. They're you know, not nice people. And I was upset about that because, you know, I thought, you know, all these people are going to really think I'm a sympathetic character. And I did that. But that's what he does. He doesn't want you to like these people. That's who they are. And Vito missed a life, and he wanted to get back and, you know, get back in the mob life. And that's what he missed, the action. It was a little boring, although it was great seeing people, you know, gays living with straight people, getting along and live and let live. But is that other life that he missed, and his kids, you know.
Let's talk about how you were killed. There's like three guys with bats who are waiting, baseball bats, waiting for you in your motel room.
Pool sticks.
Oh, pool sticks. Oh, I remember them as bats. Okay, they're pool sticks. Yeah. So and then Phil Leotardo, who's the number two in the New York mob, is just like sitting on the bed, watching as they beat you to death. And of course, you're his brother-in-law. So can you talk about shooting that scene and how much of a beating you actually took in it?
Well, first of all, did you notice what Phil came out of, right?
What do you mean what he came out of? Oh, he came from behind the curtain, you mean?
No.
Was it a closet?
Came out of the closet.
You know, in my mind, I always remember things wrongly. In my mind, he's like standing behind like the drapes in the room, and he comes behind. So he came out of the closet. That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah,
really
that's funny. That's David Chase's sense of humor.
Boy, that went right past me.
Yeah. So they, first of all, because of my, you know, I just had double hip replacement.
In real life.
Yes. 7 weeks ago. And you always see me limping on the show. Mm-hmm. And my legs are crooked. It's really hard to watch. Now, you know, I'm pain-free. I was in so much pain, but I'm pain-free. And so it was hard to do a lot of these scenes. And I for the most part, I try to do as much as I could. And, you know, in the fight scene, I couldn't get down. But I pushed the guy, and I did as much as I could, but it was very painful. But so I walked in, and they didn't really, they didn't hit me. They hit the stunt double. Or did they hit me? I think they did hit me, but then I was down on the ground. They showed that. But a lot of the stuff my stunt double did. And that scene there, I mean, it was really pleading for my life, and it was very emotional. And
you're pleading with gaffer's tape over your mouth. You're trying to plead.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. They didn't use a lot of it, which I was surprised about. I remember I actually had chest pains because I was really, you know, pleading for my life, and I was upset that they didn't use more of it because I thought it was a great moment for me. Because you saw the terror in my eyes, you know.
So this season, you lost a lot of weight in real life. I read it was like 160 pounds while the show was on hiatus.
Huh?
Did you have to like tell the people I lost 160 pounds, so you'd better write it in?
No. They know I did it. Maybe at the end of season 5. Which is maybe like almost 3 years ago now, I had the band. See, I was very thin, and then I started opening restaurants, and I started gaining weight, maybe 10, 12 pounds a year. I stopped going to the gym. I didn't have time to work out, stopped being active, and then my hips were bothering me, so I didn't realize what it was. So I went less and less and started eating and drinking and gambling, which we'll get into about what's in my book. But 10, 12 pounds a year, and then finally I had enough, so I had the band done, the gastric band. And, you know, I started, that was in the end of season 5, I had it done. And when we came back, I just, you know, was losing weight. So if maybe 2.5 year period. So they knew I had it done, and they knew that, you know, there was going to be a weight loss. So they worked it into the script.
There's several characters on the show who are very heavy. I mean, over the years, like Big Pussy, Bobby. Tony's put on a few pounds lately.
Yeah, Tony put on... Well, Bobby Bacala, they put a fat suit on him.
Oh,
that
really?
It wasn't his gut, no. Oh. He's a big guy, and he put on some weight, but that wasn't... He had a big gut on. They took it off him this year.
Huh.
Tony's put on weight, and I think that was for another role he did. And I think it goes with his character. I mean, that's an end joke. Like, you know, 9 times out of 10, anytime you see him, it's usually in the house. He's always eating.
Do you think your weight helped you get the part?
Yeah, I think I definitely did. I think they were looking for a big guy. I mean, there is a lot of big guys in the mob. You know, they eat. There's a story about this guy, undercover guy. He put on 80 pounds, you know, when he was doing undercover. You know, because it's all about restaurants and eating out and, you know, it's the life.
Joey Ganascoli speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our salute to the Sopranos, resuming an interview Terry conducted last year with one of its cast members.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Ganascoli, and he plays Vito Spadafore in The Sopranos.
Played,
yes. That's right.
We could use past tense now.
He's been whacked. It's all over for Vito unless he comes back in dreams. Uh-huh. But as for Joe Ganascoli, this is probably really good for you. I mean, you have so much attention now because of this... This season that probably open up doors for you, and
I hope so.
And also, I want to ask you about your novel. You have a novel that you co-wrote called A Meal to Die For, subtitled A Culinary Novel of Crime. And this is about a guy who owns a restaurant that's you know connected with small time crime. You've worked in a lot of restaurants. You've owned one or more restaurants. Do people want to think that you've been connected? Does that give you, like, more cred as a Sopranos character?
Well, I think we all were at one point. We know guys that are in this life, you know, being from Brooklyn. I know who is and who isn't and what's their position and so on and so forth. But this book I wrote was loosely based on my life as a chef, and I was a bad gambler. I used to gamble a lot. I mean, that's what led me to acting. But I was... when I was gambling and losing, I used to lose, you know, you win, you lose, you win, you lose, but you never beat the bookie. You never beat the odds. And one Sunday, I lost $60,000 gambling on football games. 15, 15, and then 30 was my get-even game. And if I ever win an award, I got to thank Cody Carlson because he was the backup quarterback for the Houston Oilers back in 1990, and it was a Sunday. And they were resting their players for the playoffs. The Pittsburgh Steelers, number one defense, were resting their players. And Cody Carlson, the backup quarterback for Warren Moon, threw for like 500 yards. And I was just like sitting in there watching the game stunned and thinking like, I just lost $60,000. I got to get out. I got to pay everybody off. I got to sell my interest in the restaurant. And I'm moving to L.A. to pursue acting.
What made you think you'd make money as an actor?
Well, back then, before you even answer that, when I was winning and losing, you know, I was, to help pay my debts off, I was became known as a food fence. And
what's a food fence?
A food fence, like a jewelry fence, but I knew how to move hot food. And wine with phony labels, homemade wine, we would make phony wine labels and sell them, you know, not what it was. Or oil transfusions, we call them, and, you know, canola oil cut with, like... some bootleg olive oil, and then we'd, recan them or we'd rebottle them. So I know how to do that.
So you basically put cheap food in fancy bottles.
Yeah, it wasn't what it said it was. Not that it was bad. I mean, you know, I said a little integrity, but it just wasn't what it said it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so on. So
you felt okay about doing that?
Well, at the time, and I was like hustling, you know. you know, not something. It just, you know, it was something I would use, but it just wasn't what it said it was. And, you know, I was hustling. That's what we do in Brooklyn.
So you didn't mind that you were taking advantage of people?
Well, you know, back then, I have more scruples now, or some, but and that's what the book's about. But you know, this is how I had it. You know, I hustled. You know, if someone said, "Listen, I got this shrimp," you know, "can you move it?" And I say, "Yeah, I'd move it."
Joey Ganascoli speaking to Terry Gross last year. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. This is Dominic Chianese singing. He plays Uncle Junior. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
State vicino a me fino alla sera. Tu non puoi sapere come sei cara. Accarezzami come c'è, accarezza luna. Accarezzami come mar, accarezza rena. Amma dormi come te la giari, te voglio bene. Come te la giari, non me lascio.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children. On the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After going for therapy herself, Lorraine Bracco landed the part of Tony Soprano's psychiatrist. Coming up, we talk with her about playing Dr. Melfi. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Grindhouse, and we continue our interview with Joey Ganascoli. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Joey Ganascoli, who played Vito Spadafore on The Sopranos. Vito was killed last season, and in the coming months, as the series presents its final episodes, he's bound to have plenty of company. Ganascoli used to be in the restaurant business. When we left off, he was telling Terry that he decided to get out of the business and pursue acting after he lost $60,000 gambling.
I called up my friend Tim Kelleher, who's a working actor, and I said, Tim, I told him what happened. He goes, I said, I'm just going to go out in L.A. and pursue it. And I did that for 3.5 years, just getting bit parts, and I was hustling. But, you know, I was tired of being broke again. I moved back to L.A. My family wouldn't even talk to me for the first year because of, you know, what I did. I lost everything. I left this girl I was seeing and so on. And then I was, you know, working menial, cooking and jobs, cooking in restaurants and not making much money. I was tired of that. But, you know, again, because I'm from Brooklyn, what I used to do is, you know what the breakdowns, I don't know if you know what the breakdowns are.
Is that for betting?
No.
Oh.
Breakdowns are what the casting directors...
Oh.
Yeah, send out to what they'll, you know, for episodes and movies, episodic TVs. And if they're looking for a character, say, 40 years old, 6 lines, balding, you know, it's a description of what they need for the movie or the episode, you know? And the only one that get these breakdowns are the agents. So I started working with this agent out of his house, but he was a young kid. He wasn't like, you know, I'd be up at 6 o'clock, where I'm gonna go, drinking coffee, wait until 9 o'clock so I can go to his house and help him go through it just to see what's out there. And I was wondering if they were submitting me. Well, he's submitting me for the, you know, sending my picture. And then hopefully I get the call. And I'd say, did you call? So this lasted about 2 weeks. And I was driving him nuts, you know. So I says, you know what? I don't really trust this guy. I don't think he's doing the right job. So I would go up, wake up at 5 in the morning, run to his house, grab these breakdowns, run to Kinko's, copy them, then bring them back to his house, and then I would go through them myself. And I started submitting my own picture. And then I would call up in a few days and say, listen, my name is James Hoving. I'm Joe Ganascoli's manager. I'm in town for a few days, and I want to make
sure
that
you would pretend that you were James Hoving, Joe Ganascoli's manager? Okay.
Yes. And I would, they'd say, who are you? I said, James Hoving. I'm Joe Ganascoli's manager. I want to make sure I'm in town for a few days. I want to make sure that he gets seen for this role. And they go, what? Where'd you say you were from? And I say, I'd have to say it. And I change my answering machine at home, say, James Hoving talent. I say, you know, I have an East Coast and a West Coast office. And that's how I started getting auditions. That's how I got my first role. And I got my SAG card.
Did anyone discover this, like, little con game you were playing?
No. And then my roommate, who Tim, you know, the Jesuit, he says, listen, I need a James Hoving call. Can you call for me? And I'd say, call for him. You know, the funny story is that he wanted to get seen for a Bobby Kennedy movie. And I said, listen, you got to see Tim Caleri. He's great. As a matter of fact, I signed him when he was playing all three Kennedys in an off-Broadway play. And because his agent wanted to get him in, and I got him in he didn't get the role, but I got him in for the audition. So everybody was asking me to make James. I even Hoving calls because I started submitting. You know, I said, listen, there's a thing that's being cast you're really right for. So submit yourself, and I'll call up. And so I was doing people favors.
So did James Hoving help you get your role in The Sopranos?
No. By that time, you know, I was back in New York. You know, I did maybe, I did those two movies. And they said, just call us up and see, you know, what you're right for. So they said, well, listen, we're doing this show called The Sopranos, and we want to bring you in. And at the time, I didn't want to do it because I said, well, I don't want to do TV. I just want to do film. And they said, no, you come in and do this. It's going to be big. And you know, it was.
So, tell me one of your favorite stories about life on the set at The Sopranos.
Let's see. Well, usually when we kill someone, we take them out to dinner. I haven't got my dinner yet.
Oh, God, really?
we took Jackie Jr., we took the guy who hung himself, Bobby Fornaro. I'm waiting for, that's usually a fun night.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Joey Ganascoli speaking to Terry Gross last year. His character of Vito is dead now, but lives on, and dies again, in the latest Sopranos DVD box set. Coming up, a Sopranos cast member who's still cashing paychecks, Lorraine Bracco, who plays Tony's therapist, Dr. Melfi. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Dr. Melfi, the therapist who has helped Tony Soprano confront his demons, has been a key Sopranos character from the first episode. She's still with us, talking Tony through his latest fixations, legacy and mortality. Dr. Melfi is played by Lorraine Bracco, who spoke with Terry Gross last year. Let's listen in to a therapy session. Tony, played by James Gandolfini, is in Dr. Melfi's office and has just told her he hates his son, AJ.
Anthony, I think your anger towards AJ has been building for some time. We have to deal with this.
All I know is it's a good thing my father's not alive, because let me tell you, he'd find this f***ing hilarious.
Find what hilarious?
The kind of son I produced.
You mean because Anthony doesn't conform to your father's idea of what a man should be?
His, mine, or anybody's. Let me tell you, if Carmella let me kick AJ's ass like my father kicked my ass, he might have gone up with some balls.
Like you?
Yeah, like me.
He might have also grown up taking out his anger at his father's brutality towards him on others. He might have grown up with a desperate need to dominate and control. Anthony, we've been dancing around this for years. How you live. What is it you want from your life?
I couldn't even hit him if I wanted to. He's so f***ing little. It's Carmella's side of the family. They're small people. Her father, you could knock him over with a f***ing feather.
Okay. But I have to point out, what you resent Carmella doing for AJ, protecting him from his father, is the very thing you had often wished your mother had done for you.
Lorraine Bracco, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the best advice you've ever given Tony Soprano?
You know, I do love the fact that she continues to try to make him look at his relationship with the mother. I think that's a very important aspect of his issues. And so anything that surrounds Olivia, I think, is always very interesting. I don't know if it's advice in the advice sense, but I like all the stuff with the mother. I think it's all very, very interesting. And, of course, pokes and prods him in ways that he squirms, and I like that.
I can't remember how many seasons ago this was when your character was raped.
Yes.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, it's such a violation of your character. I don't mean a script writing violation. I mean, rape is an incredible violation. And on the one hand,
I was stunned.
Yeah, on the one hand, when something major happens in the life of one of the characters, it seems like good news for the actor because you get more attention. But did you feel the pain, you know, when the character was raped?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, David came to me and said, okay, I don't remember what season or what episode, but he said, come into my office. And we sat down and he started to tell me the story. And I was like, what? Why would you hurt Dr. Melfi? Why would you do that to her? Well, it's a random rape. I said, David, I'm the only decent person here. Why would you do that to me? And he said, okay, all right, let's not get hysterical. Read the script and call me. So he gave me the script, you know, a couple of weeks or a month before, you know, we were even going to go into it. And I read the script and I read it again. And it was the second time that I read it, I said, okay, I get it. It wasn't about hurting Dr. Melfi. It wasn't the violence against her. What it was her morality. And yes, she could have told Tony. And yes, she could have become a gangster.
She could have asked him for revenge, and he would have gladly taken revenge.
Of course he would have. But it was the question of her morality. Who was she? And to me, that was so much bigger than anything. And a lot of people, I'm not sure 100% got that. I mean, my father was standing up, screaming at the television, screaming, tell him, tell him. And, I mean, you know, it was like, well, then she would have just become one of them.
Now, when the series started, you were going through a terrible depression, which you write about in your new memoir. You were going through a bad separation with Harvey Keitel, who you'd been with for years. You had a daughter together, and you were having a custody battle over your daughter. Oh, and you were very, very deep in debt, like $2 million, in part because of the steep legal fees that you had to pay. And you finally went into therapy. Did therapy help you through that depression?
Oh, yes, it did. And medication helped me.
What are the therapy, since you're playing a therapist now and have to really think about the value and the limitations of therapy, what did the therapy do for you? What are some of the insights that it gave you that you could actually use to change your life?
All right, well, you know, when you ask that question, my mind is going all over the place. A couple of things I want you to know. David Chase has been through therapy. And when I met David and we talked about Dr. Melfi, one of the things I said to him was, listen, I don't really know you very well right now and you don't know me, but I've been in therapy and I've been in crisis mode. And therapy was very, very important to me. And I told him also that I'd been on medication. And he was very open, and I say we had a very strong meeting. And I was very open with him because I didn't want him to think that, besides it was a great role that I loved, it was something that I was working on. And I said to him, the therapy had been very important to me, and I wasn't willing to make a mockery of therapy. I was not willing to become the psycho killer. I wasn't willing to become the sex fiend psychiatrist. And if he had those plans for this character, I was not his girl. Because in my own life, I always felt it saved me. And David was very honest and open with me and said he'd been in therapy and been through a lot. And no, he wasn't going to make a mockery of the therapy. Would he take a little artistic license? Yes. I said, that I could live with. But I won't live with, you know, the sex fiend psychiatrist who, you know, dances in the bada bing.
You know, you first became really well known for your role in Goodfellas as Karen Hill, the woman who becomes the wife of the wise guy of the film, the small-time mobster, Henry Hill. It was directed by Martin Scorsese, who you already knew through your longtime partner, Harvey Keitel. In the film, your character of Karen is Jewish, and of course Henry Hill is Italian.
Italian Irish.
Now, you grew up in, you're Catholic, you grew up in Bay Ridge, and then when you were a little older, your family moved to a neighborhood in Long Island that was primarily Jewish. And you said, you know, all your friends were in B'nai B'rith, so you wanted to join too, even though you're Catholic, but that's what everybody was doing. So did spending part of your growing up time in a Jewish neighborhood help you in playing Karen?
I think it's why Marty gave me the role.
How did it help
you? I mean, that's because I knew both sides of the coin. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. I was the only, you know, Catholic kid. And I was Catholic with an Italian father at home. So I understood both lives. And that intrigued Marty. And Marty always felt I could play Jewish. not just Italian. I could do that. And the fact that I was from Long Island, and that's where Karen Hill was originally from Lawrence.
Well, I want to play a scene from Goodfellas, and this is a scene you and Henry Hill have recently married, but you're both living in your parents' house. And In this scene, Henry Hill has been out all night, and it's not the first time. And your mother is really mad at him, and I think she's kind of mad at you for marrying him in the first place. So this is a scene with you and your mother.
And just, I know this has got nothing to do with nothing, but you realize Suzanne Shepherd, who plays my mother in Goodfellas, plays, come on, Terry. Come on, it's a great trivia question.
I don't know.
Plays Edie's mother in Sopranos.
No, really?
Same actress.
I didn't realize that.
Ah, see?
Oh, you got me. That's great.
All right, just a little trivia.
Well, that's great. Well, let's hear the scene and we can think about that as we listen.
He didn't call?
He's with his friends.
What kind of a person doesn't call?
Ma, he's a grown-up. He doesn't have to call every 5 minutes.
If he was such a grown-up, why doesn't he get you to an apartment?
Oy, don't start. Mom, you're the one who wanted us here.
Listen, you're here a month, and sometimes I know he doesn't come home at all. What kind of people are these?
Ma, what do you want me to do?
Do? What can you do? He's not Jewish. Did you know how these people live? Did you know what they were like? Your father never stayed out all night without calling.
Stay out? Daddy never went out at all, Ma. Keep out of it! You don't know how I feel!
Feel? How do you feel now? You don't know where he is. You don't know who he's with.
He's with his friends! Dad!
Will you leave him out of this? He suffered enough. The man hasn't been able to digest a decent meal in 6 weeks.
That's my guest, Lorraine Bracco, with Suzanne Shepherd in a scene from Goodfellas. I have another question about Dr. Melfi. One of the things I sometimes wonder about Dr. Melfi is this. When seeing Tony Soprano, would she really be wearing skirts and stockings that reveal her very beautiful legs? Or would she be trying to be as like non-sexual as possible in a therapy relationship like that?
Okay, so I have a couple of things on the subject. You ready?
Yes.
One, Terry.
Yes.
It is a TV show. And Mr. Gandolfini goes to our fantastic costume designer, Juliet, and begs her to shorten my skirts. Just so you know, a little artistic license there. If you know me and if you meet me, you will see I'm a much more alive woman than Dr. Melfi. And I have a big sexuality about me. So Dr. Melfi is, for me, I work so hard to tone her down and not be me. People just can't believe when they meet me in person, they say, oh my God, they make you so ugly on television. But because I don't bring in me, I don't bring in Lorraine Bracco. Yes, there's a part of me I bring in, but I have to glue my ass down to the chair. I have to get rid of me to make her.
Lorraine Bracco, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're sweet, Terry. I hope you had fun.
Lorraine Bracco speaking to Terry Gross last year. The final episodes of The Sopranos begin rolling out on HBO Sunday. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Grindhouse. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before the multiplexes, before the age of the VCR and DVD, there was a kind of independent theater known as the grindhouse. It was typically dilapidated and urban in places like New York's old 42nd Street. And the bill always was a double or triple feature. Exploitation, sexploitation, blaxploitation, or maybe an Italian cannibal or Mondo picture, often accompanied by the sound of winos snoring. Today's exploitation auteurs, Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez, have collaborated on a cinematic time machine called Grindhouse. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Grindhouse is both an ode to the era of scuzzy exploitation theaters and an orgy for those who want to live or relive the dream. It's a three-hour switchback ride into the belly of the B-movie beast. Two rowdy full-length features, a slew of garish fake-coming attractions, and steady eruptions of carnage and cruelty. All I missed from the old days were the pungent aromas of urine and dope. Robert Rodriguez wrote and directed the first feature, Planet Terror. Quentin Tarantino took the reins for the second, called Death Proof. The boisterously shallow Rodriguez serves up an entertaining Tex-Mex bouillabaisse, a zombie contagion shoot-em-up in which the blood explodes like water balloons. There's some kind of Iraq chemical weapon that's gotten loose, but I couldn't follow it, frankly. Bruce Willis pops up as an infected commando whose face bubbles when he stops breathing the short-term antidote through a gas mask. But the movie's central, luscious camera object is Rose McGowan, who opens Planet Terror with a semi-naked pole dance. When rampaging zombies rip off one of her gams and the hot rod hero, played by Freddie Rodriguez, screws a submachine gun into her stump, McGowan edges out Uma Thurman in Kill Bill as the ultimate abused and fetishized action movie femme. In Planet Terror's brief but tumultuous running time, Rodriguez pays homage to a long line of directors, from Howard Hawks to George Romero to John Carpenter to Tarantino, who shows up as an actor in his favorite kind of role, a sexual sadist who gets a gory comeuppance. Which brings us to Tarantino's Death Proof, in which the brutality is more shocking, because we get to know the characters. What makes some critics' knee-jerk derision of Tarantino so vexing is that he's more than a violence peddler. He's a humanist. Okay, he's a predatory humanist. He just loves to hang out with the characters who are going to get roughed up and killed. In this case, it's two sets of women. The first three are a celebrity Austin DJ known as Jungle Julia, played by Sydney Tamia Poitier, and her friends Shanna, played by Jordan Ladd, and Arlene, played by Vanessa Ferlito. All three are chafing under their roles as women of color and objects of lust. But they do stretch out in short shorts while they're chafing. In a local watering hole, they're eyeballed by a scarred macho man at the bar who calls himself Stuntman Mike and drives a black Charger he boasts is reinforced for high-speed collisions and rollovers. Death Proof. That's Kurt Russell.
Do I frighten you? Is it my scar?
It's your car.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
Have you been following us?
No, but that's what I love about Austin. It's just so damn small.
You've seen this guy before?
I saw him outside of Guero's.
And I saw you outside Guero's, too. You saw my car, I saw your legs. Now look, I ain't stalking y'all, but I didn't say I wasn't a wolf.
So you really weren't following us?
I'm not following you, butterfly. I just got lucky.
The second set of women take over the film before we've fully digested the fate of the first. But these are ladies of a different stripe, fresh from a movie shoot, including Rosario Dawson as a makeup person and a pair of stunt women, played by Tracy Toms and real-life stunt person Zoe Bell. They gush about vintage speedsters and car movies like Vanishing Point and Dirty Mary Crazy Larry. They remind you that Grindhouse has offered powerful women before Hollywood did, from Russ Meyer's big-breasted kickboxers to Pam Grier's foxy vigilantes. Death Proof is a grim stalker picture, a car chase picture, and a raucous anthem to female empowerment. It seems dredged up from the psyche of a movie freak who loves women on screen almost as much as he loves to punish women on screen, and who gets off most on his own ambivalence. The fun of Grindhouse is in our breathless anticipation of what they'll hurl at us next. And I'm sad that, like all movies, it will be seen by most people on video. It should be consumed in a theater, full of live, shrieking, gasping, cheering, exploitation movie junkies, just like in the old days. We get too much sex and violence at home, in front of our TVs. We need to get out more.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Year of Fog, a novel that explores the family drama that unfolds when a child disappears, by Michelle Richmond. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the Joyce Foundation, supporting efforts to educate America's workforce and improve the quality of teaching in low-achieving schools, JoyceFDN.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer-director Mike White. His films include Nacho Libre, The School of Rock, Orange County, and Chuck and Buck. His new film, Year of the Dog, stars Molly Shannon and Peter Sarsgaard. Join us for the next Fresh Air.